Poets, perhaps better than anyone, understand the power of a well-chosen word, or an ill-chosen one, for that matter. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, the famous poet, once began one of his poems with this rather famous line, "I shot an arrow into the air, it fell to the earth, I know not where." And in the course of that poem, he uses the analogy of the arrow fired in terms of a word, or a song, or a poem. That a word is like an arrow launched, and you don't know exactly where it's going to land or what it's going to do. Another poet, Ella Wheeler Wilcox, picked up the same idea of arrows and applies it, I think, a little more directly to words. She writes, "You never can tell when you send a word like an arrow shot from a bow, by an archer blind, be it cruel or kind, just where it may chance to go. It may pierce the breast of your dearest friend, tipped with poison or balm. To a stranger's heart in life's great mart, it may carry its pain or its calm." So every word that leaves our mouth is like an arrow released from a bow. But if we're not careful, it can cause great damage. Sometimes our words are less like arrows and more like cannonballs. Back in 2011, you might be familiar with this story, the TV show Mythbusters. Again, if you know the show, it's about Adam and Jamie, the two hosts of the show, test all kinds of myths, urban legends, and try and prove them either right or wrong. And in this particular incident in 2011, they were testing a myth having to do with a cannon. And they were doing this experiment in the town of Dublin, California. They were firing the cannon towards these large water containers. Well, here's what the news report after the event said. "The cantaloupe-sized cannonball missed the water, tore through a cinder block wall, skipped off a hillside, and flew some 700 yards east. The cannonball then bounced in front of a home on a quiet street, ripped through the front door, raced up the stairs, blasted through the bedroom. It exited the house, leaving a perfectly round hole in the stucco, crossed six-lane road, took out several tiles on the roof of another house, and then finally slammed into a family's minivan that was parked in the driveway." I think they underestimated just how far a cannonball could go and just how much damage it could do. One of the people affected, the owner of the minivan, said, "It's shocking anything like this could have happened." And I think about that. I think of our words like a reckless cannonball fired. We don't necessarily know where it's going to end up or what damage it's going to do on the way. In fact, sometimes our words may be said innocently enough, at least in our own mind, and yet they have unintended consequences. Proverbs chapter 12, verse 18 says, "There is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts, but the tongue of the wise brings healing." So our words, once they've launched, can have all kinds of effects. And perhaps you've seen this firsthand, either with your own words, maybe when you've said something that ended up having some effect you didn't anticipate, or perhaps you were the recipient of those words. In all likelihood, it's probably both. Again, we look at the Proverbs 18:21. The Bible is right when it says, "Death and life are in the power of the tongue." The tongue, when it's unrestrained, is a dangerous thing. It issues forth complaints, arguments, slander, gossip, angry, hurtful words, profanity, lies, false accusations. The fact is, and we're all aware of this, that wars have been started, marriages ended, childhoods ruined, and blood shed, all because of words. So be careful how you use your tongue. Or to say it a different way, you must control your tongue or your tongue will control you. Control your tongue or your tongue will control you. Now, you might be sitting here this morning thinking, that sounds like a whole lot of exaggeration, Reed. Can words really do all that? Aren't you overstating it? Well, if we had asked James the same question, he would say, absolutely not. In fact, James turns the rhetoric up to 11 when he talks about the tongue. He's holding nothing back. In fact, he goes further than most of us, I think, would be comfortable with in trying to show how important words and our words are. This is one of those passages that hits hard. and it demands much. And so when you read a passage like this, get ready to be convicted. That's what we ought to feel. Now, back in James chapter 1, verse 26 and 27, James talks about the marks of authentic religion. And he says, if anyone is religious and does not bridle his tongue, he deceives his heart. So in James' mind, how a person uses their tongue is indicative of what's inside of them, whether it is true faith or just word. The tongue is the test of one's religious claims. Why? Because the tongue is one of the hardest parts of our body to control. We may bring other things in our life. Maybe we can put on a show. Maybe we can wear the mask of the hypocrite quite well. But sooner or later, our tongue will tell. And so James is going to expand what he mentioned back in 1:27 into a whole section here in chapter 3. You can't really talk about faith demonstrated, which is James' main idea in this book. You can't talk about it without talking about our speech, how we use our words. So what I want to do, and this is going to be a two-part message. I was going to try and do all 12 verses, because it's really one section, but there's too much to talk about. And so I've broken this into two parts, so be prepared for a to-be-continued conclusion on this message. But even as we look at the first six verses, we'll notice that James breaks this down for us. And he begins by showing us the serious problem of the tongue. The serious problem of the tongue. According to James, this is no laughing matter. This is no insignificant, no big deal kind of thing. Our words have important ramifications. There are those, I think, who would look at this passage and say, they're just words. I mean, come on, they're just words. I mean, I was just joking anyways. Well, to the person who says, well, they're just words, I think one author said it well, that's like saying, it's just an atom bomb. What's the big deal? James forces us to take this topic seriously. Now, let's look at verse 1. He says, not many of you should become teachers, my brothers, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. Now, on first glance, you may say, well, that doesn't really have to do with the tongue. That just has to do with teachers and teaching. But it actually does connect, and we will see that in a moment. He begins here in verse 1 with this warning to would-be teachers. So those who would think to themselves, you know what, I would like to be a teacher. He says, slow down. Let's think about that. Apparently, when James was writing, there was people who wanted to be teachers in the church. Perhaps they were even clamoring for these positions. If we go back to Jewish culture from which James is writing from, a teacher or a rabbi was a very respected position. A teacher was looked up to, was honored, was praised. And so I think a lot of James' audience is probably saying, hey, that's a good career path. I would like to be the rabbi. I would like people to look up to me and consider me a bedrock of the community. But in a synagogue in the first century, there was a group of elders who managed and directed the activities of the synagogue. But anybody could have a part in the service. Here's what Bruce Chilton writes in the Dictionary of New Testament Backgrounds. He says, any male could be called upon to pray or to read a portion of the Torah or prophets in the synagogue service. Any competent individual could also be called upon to give a sermon. And by competent, in other words, if there was somebody traveling through town, for instance, who had some biblical learning, they might be asked, hey, share with us some of God's truth. This is, by the way, how Jesus, remember Jesus traveling in the Gospels, he would go to the synagogue and they would ask him to deliver the message because he was a teacher. Likewise, Paul, who had biblical training, when he traveled throughout the ancient world, he would go first to the synagogue and would be given a hearing. And there would declare Christ. Well, the early church in the time of James was set up very much like the synagogue. And we know this from 1 Corinthians chapter 14, where there were people, members of the church, who were giving prophecy and giving a word of encouragement in the service. So it was kind of an open forum in a sense. And therefore, there was an opportunity for people to step up and say, you know what, hey, I want to give the message this morning. I want to share something God's been teaching me. And James says, hold on. understand that if you are teaching others God, other people God's word, you are going to be held to a standard. You will be judged more strictly. He writes at the beginning, not many of you should become teachers. Now, he's not trying to dissuade people. I don't think he's trying to say, you know, don't be a teacher. But he's warning, he's saying, listen, if that's what you want to do, remember, there's added accountability. And I think this warning here is needed for today's church. Not many of you should become teachers. Again, I would love to have many pastors raised up from the church. But the fact is, there's some people who are wanting to be teachers who shouldn't be, or fashioning themselves as teachers who are not really. You have people today who think they're experts just because they've watched a few videos online, and now they're ready to teach the world. Again, I'm not saying that somebody has to go through 4 years of seminary, but I do know this, that I've studied Bible and theology for quite a while, and it's interesting to be lectured by somebody who's watched 4 YouTube videos and now wants to tell me, I'm going to correct all your theology. We need this warning today. Not many of you should become teachers, my brother. Why? Because a teacher leads with his words. A teacher leads with his words. If you're using your mouth to instruct, then there's great room for error. The Bible teaches in the Proverbs that where there are many words, sin increases. And so there's a great opportunity because teachers are using many words. Therefore, they are under a stricter judgment. He says here they will be judged with greater strictness. Or another way to translate that is with a greater judgment. It's the principle in the Bible of to whom much is given, much will be required. If you're a teacher, then you will be judged on that. If a person misrepresents the message of Jesus, teaches what is false, if he misleads people from the truth, there's going to be a greater judgment. Here's 3 reasons, very quickly, why there's stricter judgment for the one who's a teacher. Number 1, teachers are entrusted with the truth. You've been given the truth. You're teaching it. Be faithful with it. Don't twist it. Don't misrepresent it. Don't try and come up with your own angle on it. Secondly, the teacher's message is meant to change lives. So if I'm teaching something that's not right, that's not true, or somehow leading people astray, their lives are going to be conformed to that message. And then third, teachers are meant to model the truth. This is where I think most teachers probably fall under this strict judgment. They may teach true things and may say everything very well, but their own lives don't reflect what they teach. So teachers are meant to model the truth. By the way, you'll notice in verse 1, he says, we who teach. So James is including himself in that. Therefore, he's not saying, you know, nobody should be a teacher. Let's just do away with that role. He's saying, no, I'm one. And it's a good thing, but no, there's a greater judgment. Why? Because we use our words, and our words is what oftentimes gets us into trouble. So not only do we see a warning here to would-be teachers, we notice also that this is not just a problem for teachers. Verse 2, for we all, not just teachers, we all stumble in many ways. And if anyone does not stumble in what he says, that is, in his words, in his speech, he is a perfect man able to bridle his whole body. So somebody should think twice about standing up to teach others because we know, you know what? We all stumble. We all fall. We all make mistakes. That includes, by the way, pastors and preachers and teachers. And let me just include this here. This is one of those verses that reminds us, as James has done several times in this book, that none of us are perfect, right? We all stumble in many ways. That's why the gospel's important, isn't it? You're not a perfect person. I'm not either. All of us fall short of the standard God has given. But what is God's standard? It is holy perfection. You say, well, how can God have a standard of holy perfection if none of us are going to be holy? Well, again, he is God. But he has made a way for us to find the forgiveness of our sins, that our record is washed clean. So this idea that we all stumble is part and parcel of the gospel. But he says one of the chief ways that we stumble is through our words. Right? He says, if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man. In other words, you've at least reached maturity. The word he uses here is not necessarily perfect. It means you've reached maturity. You've reached your final phase of development. So he's saying, look, if you're somebody who can control, like you never say anything wrong, you never, you know, have a slip of the tongue, you never, accidentally, you know, or maybe embarrassed or feel convicted about something you've said, well, then you've reached it. Because that's the one area in our life that's hardest to get under control. If someone's speech is erratic, if it's impure, if it's hurtful, if it's gossipy, that shows they have a long way to go in Christian maturity. So we all stumble. This is not just a problem for teachers. All of us struggle with the tongue. But then James provides for us three illustrations about the significance of the tongue. So it's a problem, yes, but he's going to illustrate just how serious the problem is. Starting in verse 3, he says, if we put bits into the mouth of horses so that they obey us, we guide the whole bodies as well. Look at ships also. Though they are large and are driven by strong winds, they are guided by a very small rudder wherever the will of the pilot directs. So also the tongue is a small member, yet it boasts of great things. How great a forest is set ablaze by such a small fire. So three illustrations James uses on the significance of the tongue. First of all, he uses the illustration of the bridle in verse 3. He says, we put bits into the mouth of horses so that we can guide them. And you notice that all of these illustrations are pointing to the same truth. A small thing has a big impact. It controls the whole course of the animal, the whole course of the ship. Now, as I understand, and I'm not a horse person, so I can't even remember if I've ever ridden a horse. If I did, it was a long, long time ago. But a bridle has a lot of different parts to it, including the reins and all that. But the bit is what James has in mind. It's this little piece that goes in the horse's mouth and allows the rider to kind of control the horse by putting pressure. And it's very small, and yet a horse is very, very large, very, very powerful creature. So small a thing can control and direct where the horse will go. And so it is with the tongue. Very small in comparison to our whole body, yet it directs the course of our life. People's opinion of us, our reputation, the work we do, our effectiveness in serving the Lord is determined in a large degree by how we speak. So he uses the illustration of the bridle. Secondly, he uses the illustration of the rudder. In verse 4, look at the ships. They're also large. And not only are they large, they're driven by strong winds. So powerful creations. And yet, they're steered by this tiny little rudder. Now, I found this interesting. I was doing the research on this week. And it's interesting that over 2,000 years, you know, ships have been actually around much longer than 2,000 years. But in ancient times, they would use a rudder to steer it. And you know what we use today? I mean, ships have changed a lot. Think about an aircraft carrier. Here you have a ship that's literally a floating city. It's powered by nuclear fusion. And yet, how do they steer it? They use a rudder. So some things have not changed. You know, we've advanced a lot, but we still use a rudder to pilot a ship. Now, in the case of an aircraft carrier, it's not a very little rudder, is it? There's three rudders that control a large aircraft carrier. Each one's about three stories tall and weighs 55 tons. So not exactly small. But when you compare it to the size of an aircraft carrier, that 55-ton rudder is 0.05% of the overall mass of the ship. 0.05. By the way, your tongue only weighs 2 ounces. Do you know how much that is of your overall mass? 0.05. It's the same amount of your body is tied up in the tongue as the rudder on an aircraft carrier. But like the rudder, the tongue will determine where we go, whether good or bad. And then Lastly, he talks about the spark. The spark. Just like a bit and a rudder, the spark starts off small but can create a great fire. He says in verse 5, so also the tongue is a small member. It's very small, yet it boasts of great things. J.B. Phillips, in his famous paraphrase of the New Testament, writes, the human tongue is physically small, but what tremendous effect it can boast of. I appreciate this quote from Curtis Vaughn. He writes, it can sway men to violence, or it can move them to the noblest action. It can instruct the ignorant, encourage the dejected, comfort the sorrowing, and soothe the dying. Or it can crush the human spirit, destroy reputations, spread distrust and hate, and bring nations to the brink of war. So James says in the latter part of verse 5, how great a forest is set ablaze by such a small little fire. All it takes is a spark and the right conditions, and you have a vast forest fire. Not something we have to deal with too often in Ohio, but in California and out west, forest fires are a really serious problem. And oftentimes those fires start with just a small spark. One of the most serious wildfires in recent history, back in 18 or 19, the fire was started by a hammer driving a stake into the ground. A dry day, sledgehammer slamming on the stake created enough of a spark that it burned 500,000 acres and destroyed 18,000 buildings. That sounds pretty serious to me. It sounds kind of like a cannonball launched, not knowing where it's going to land or where it's going to end up. The idea is it doesn't take much, and so it is with our words. It doesn't take much. It's a pretty serious problem, the tongue. We'll get this even more as we continue in the passage, but how we use our words really matters. It's not inconsequential. It's not just words. It's not something we can just brush off as, well, I didn't mean it. I wasn't being serious. I was just kidding. Our words can have serious repercussions. It's not insignificant. It's a serious problem. Okay, well, we get that. Our tongue, our words are serious. It's a serious matter. But James also wants us to see the destructive power of the tongue. We may say, oh, well, it's serious. I know I need to be careful with my words. But here James makes it even more serious by showing the destructive power that our tongues have, just like that stray cannonball. Now, he's already said our tongue is a fire. But he's going to drive this home, even picking up in the middle of verse 5. He says, how great a forest is set ablaze by only a small fire, and the tongue is a fire. A world of unrighteousness. The tongue is set among the members, staining the whole body, setting on fire the entire course of our life, and is set on fire by hell. I can't think of a more dire way of stating what James has just said. He compares the tongue to a fire. And just like a fire, it can be good or bad depending on where it is. Right? I mean, a fire, if it's in your fireplace, warming your house, is a very good thing. You can use it to stay warm. You can use it to cook on. But if you have a fire that's raging uncontrolled, that's going to do a lot of damage to your house. And so it is with words. When used appropriately, when used rightly, they can have a great effect. But when they go awry, they can cause great damage. I mean, we're capable of burning people and destroying things that are dear to us with our words. The tongue is a fire, he says at the beginning of verse 6. It's a metaphor. It packs a punch. You know, maybe we would use words a little bit differently if we thought that they were on fire. Now, I'm not going to just launch words out if I knew they were blazing. You know, legend is filled with stories of fire-breathing dragons. All over the world, there's different legends of fire-breathing dragons. Well, that's what James is saying you and I are. We're fire-breathing dragons. When we speak, be careful, there's fire coming out. And if we don't point it in the right direction, we're liable to burn someone or something. James points out that if our words are unchecked, first of all, they are defiling. They are defiling. See this in verse 6. The tongue is a fire, a world of unrighteousness, a world of iniquity that's set amongst your members. In other words, among all the parts of our body, there's no part of us that's more or has a greater potential for sin and for hurtful damage. Do you remember what Jesus said concerning the tongue? He said, whatever comes out of a person's mouth, that it is that defiles him. Not so much what you eat, because again, that was the quabble amongst the Jews was, you know, are we eating clean or unclean? Jesus says, it's not what you put in, it's what comes out of your mouth that is going to defile you. Kurt Richardson, who wrote a commentary on James, writes, contained within the tongue or speech are all the representations of wickedness in the world. There's virtually no sin which sooner or later does not employ our tongue. Pastor R. Kent Hughes states, about 9/10 of all of the problems we experience in our lives come from the tongue. 9/10. If we hate, it oftentimes comes out through our tongue in the words that we say. When we deceive, it is usually with our tongue. When we lust in our hearts, we use our lips to deny it, and so on and so forth. Our tongue is an accomplice to almost all the crimes and sin that we would do. It is a world of unrighteousness. Again, the word world here is this Greek term, cosmos, a world of unrighteousness. The word cosmos, of course, refers to the planet, but it also has another term having to do with appearance. That's where we get the word cosmetics, for instance. So some interpret this verse as saying the tongue is in the habit of making iniquity look good. It's powdering the nose of sin in order to try to make sin look presentable. It's a world of unrighteousness. It's set among our members. And then what does he say? It's staining the whole body, verse 6. Staining the whole body. The way we speak and the words we use defiles our person. If we use bad language, if we use our tongues to sin, we defile ourselves. Remember, that was part of that true religion section we saw back in 1:26 and 27. He says, pure and undefiled religion is this, caring for orphans and widows and keeping oneself unstained from the world. Well, one of the ways we stain ourselves with the world is through our tongues and how we use it. By leaving the tongue unbridled, we allow it to defile our lives by all kinds of sin. Secondly, it's not only defiling, it is decisive. Another word we could use is definitive. It's decisive. It has a way of determining the direction of our lives. You see this in verse 6. The tongue is a world of unrighteousness, set among our members, staining the whole body, setting on fire the entire course of life. So in other words, if you use your tongue wrongly, the entire course, the way your life is going to go is very badly, and it's going to be on fire the whole way. So if you want your path to be burning behind you and bridges and relationships and friendships burning in the wake, then simply speak with an unbridled tongue. Setting on fire the entire course of your life. The tongue is capable of setting your life on the wrong path. One word, one sentence, one rant can change the course that your life goes, oftentimes for the worse. In a moment of anger, you say something that you regret. It can't be taken back. The illustration that's sometimes used is that of toothpaste. You know, you squeeze toothpaste out of the tube, and I've never yet known someone to get it back in once it's been squeezed out. I mean, you can try and kind of cram it in, but all you'll end up doing is making a mess. And so it is with words. Once spoken, they can't be put back. Yeah, you can try and, you know, oh, well, I didn't mean that. But the word is spoken. It can have huge impact on your life. It's decisive. Third, it is demonic. Again, this seems almost like overstating the case, but he says at the end of the verse, setting on fire the entire course of our life and is set on fire by hell. So the tongue is a fire. It's setting our life on fire, but it gets its flames from hell itself. You know, James isn't playing around here. He's not going to let us minimize our words. James says, you are playing not with fire, you're playing with hellfire. And the word he uses, hell, here, you might know it. It's the Greek word Gehenna. It was originally used to refer to the Valley of Hinnom outside of Jerusalem. There was this valley next to the city of Jerusalem, which was kind of the garbage dump for the city. And people would take their refuse and garbage and dump it out into that valley. And the word was, there was continuous fires. People would burn their trash out there. And so any given day in Jerusalem, there would be smoke rising from this smoldering, burning heap that probably smelled awful. And so when Jesus talks about hell, he talks about Gehenna. He uses that as the mental image. He says, do you want a picture in your mind of what I'm talking about? It's this burning, stinking garbage heap. When he talks about their worm will not die, it's probably talking about the wriggling creatures that are working their way through this garbage heap. Again, that's not to say that Jesus' words are all figurative and that, oh, there's no real hell that he's speaking of. No, he's using something that they can picture to show, here's what it's really like. And so that's what James says. He says, your words are on fire. It's like you're spewing the filth of Gehenna from your mouth. What an awful picture. Stinking garbage. That's what the tongue unleashed is like. When we misuse our words, it's like hell on earth. You know, our tongue has destructive power. Again, that verse in Proverbs, death and life are in the power of the tongue. During the Second World War, there was a lot of propaganda on all sides, the Allies and the Axis. But one of the concerns amongst the Allies, especially amongst the British, was the unguarded word. They were very afraid of citizens, British citizens, talking about troop movements, talking about where their children were being deployed. And if that was overheard by someone who was a spy, it could get back to the Germans and give up the plans. And so there was a propaganda campaign run throughout England, and you'll see pictures of these posters that say, loose lips sink ships. That was the motto. Loose lips sink ships. In other words, if you're gabbing on about, you know, where your what ship your son's on and how he's headed to such and such a sea, well, that might inform the enemy. Loose lips sink ships. In other words, our words have destructive power. Our words have the opportunity, even if well-meaning, to betray our nation and sink ships. Be careful how you use this destructively powerful tongue. I read a story just this week of a mom. Her son was in a school. He had some special needs, and so he kind of struggled in school a bit. Well, one day she got a phone call from her student's teacher. She missed the call, and it went to voicemail, so she picked up her phone sometime later to listen. And the message was very sweet. It was very nice, very professional. The teacher had to inform her about some things. But the teacher forgot to hang up when the call was done. And so the voicemail continued on, and this parent, in horror and disgust, heard the teacher discussing with several others how much they disdained her son and how much they... you know, how much contempt they had for their students. You know, they thought nobody was listening. They thought this was just an insider conversation. We can just joke about, you know, our stupid students. Of course, to hear it was appalling. But that's the way we use our words. Nobody's listening. You know, we'll talk about somebody. Well, how many ways there are to misuse our tongue, whether it's gossip or deceit or outbursts of anger. talking about someone behind their back? What destructive power is in our tongues? We're going to stop here in verse 6. There's a lot more to say. In fact, we're going to pick this up, and I feel like we're kind of short-circuiting the application of this passage a little bit, but there's still some things for us to learn here. When we think of controlling our tongue, lest it control us, there are a couple steps, I think, that James would give us. Several steps for reforming our speech. Let me give them to you this morning. Step number one, take responsibility for your words. If you're always excusing or blaming someone else for the way you speak, you are not taking responsibility for your words. I only said that because he did such and such. I only said that because of the way she responded. I can't help it. They shouldn't have pushed my buttons. We find every reason and every excuse to make our words somebody else's fault. Take responsibility for your words. Don't blame shift. These are your words that come from your heart. In fact, let me point this out to you. In verse 3 and 4, he talks about these two illustrations. He says, the bit is placed in the mouth of the horse so that, what? It obeys us. Then he says, look at the ship. Though they are so large, driven by strong winds, they are guided by a very small rudder wherever the will of the pilot directs. So it's not like your tongue is just out here doing its own thing and, oh, I'm sorry, I can't control my tongue. No, your tongue has a direct connection to your heart. And frankly, that's where the problem is. Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. So if there's a problem, it's not a problem necessarily with your tongue, although that's where it comes out. The problem goes a lot deeper than that. That is, by the way, also why controlling your tongue, quote unquote, is never going to work. You might say, well, that's what you told us at the beginning. Control your tongue or it's going to control you. Here's number two, step number two. Take responsibility for your words. Step number two, submit your tongue to the control of the Holy Spirit. Or maybe we should expand that. Submit your heart, because that's where it's coming from. No matter how hard you try to, you know what, I'm just going to do better. I'm going to try and not say those particular words. Or I'm going to try and fix this. It's never going to work without a work of grace, without the Holy Spirit working within you, without you submitting to the work of the Spirit. And this is, again, where we get back to the gospel. What we need is not, oh, we need to speak better. James is not telling us here, you know, if you just clean up your talk, you're going to be good with God. No. What's James about? Faith demonstrated. But if you don't have the faith part, it doesn't matter how much you're demonstrating, it's got to have the faith. There has to be a heart change that happens because you know Jesus, because he's in your life, because he's working. Without that, you have no hope. James is saying this is faith demonstrated, not morality demonstrated. It's true living faith. If you don't have that true living faith, if you don't have that relationship with Jesus Christ who has saved you and changed you from the inside, then the tongue is just going to overflow what's in the heart. And your heart is never going to be right without the work of God. What you need is the gospel. You need forgiveness. You need grace. If you want to explore that, if you say, you know what, I don't even know if I have that relationship with Christ, come talk to me. I'd love to explain with you how you can know Jesus, how you can have a relationship with him. And then step number three. So take responsibility for your words, submit your tongue to the control of the Holy Spirit, and then use your words to build up instead of tearing down. So as you submit yourself to the Spirit's control, determine to use your words instead of to tear down, to destroy, to build up. I have a couple of different stories here to illustrate this point. Let me share with this one with you. I can't share all of them, so I'll just do this one. It's a story that goes back quite a few years, the 1950s. There was a young girl named Mary who was growing up and knew that she was different. She had a cleft lip, and so she was used to that. She was used to hearing the jokes and the ridicule and the stares and the cruelty of other kids who would make fun of the way she talked or her lip or her nose. Now, her family loved her. She understood that, but she also had this feeling of, they're my family. They have to love me, right? They don't have a choice. Like, I was born this way. They're my family. But how could anybody beyond my blood family love me? Something she doubted until she entered Miss Leonard's class. She adored her teacher, of course, but in the 1950s, as I understand, I wasn't there, but it was a common thing to give kids hearing tests in school. And so one of the things the teacher would do was would come over and basically whisper in the children's ear, and if they, you know, whisper in this ear, whisper in that ear, see if they could hear. So the teacher was doing this one day, and so Mary pretended, she basically every year when the hearing test would happen, she'd pretend that she couldn't hear. But this year, the teacher got close trying to test to see if she in fact could hear anything. And usually the teacher would just say a phrase or, you know, what color are my shoes or something like that, you know, to see if they could hear and respond to the question. Well, on this particular day, Miss Leonard whispered, did the whisper test in Mary's ear, and she said, "I wish you were my daughter." And she had never heard anybody say anything like that before. All she had heard throughout her life was, you know, you look weird, you talk funny. And to hear something like that changed the course of her life. There are many stories I could share like that, where one well-chosen word, one expression of encouragement, one blessing spoken made all the difference to someone. So often we've probably been told or heard from people, you know, oh, you're not good at that, or, you know, why do you sound so weird? To have somebody or to be somebody who speaks words of encouragement, who chooses to build up rather than tear down with our words. If that's the way we speak, then our tongue will not be a fire, a world of unrighteousness, setting on fire the course of our life and burning with that flame of hell. No, it'll be a source of blessing, a fountain of living water to those who are around us.